the National Archives podcast series, cataloguing projects during 2016.
So whenever there was a war between maritime nations, it was always the idea to go and disrupt the trade of your enemy. In the 20th century, that meant sinking the enemy's merchant ships. But that really only came about because ships were made of steel and big guns could sink them. And especially with the advent of the submarine, a submarine couldn't do anything else than sink ships. But until the 20th century, through the centuries of maritime war, it's always been the idea to capture your enemy's merchant ships rather than sink them. Obviously, it serves the same purpose. You deprive the enemy of the valuable cargo, whether it's ammunitions for directly for the war effort or whether it's just keeping on their trade and supplying the funds to keep the war. So this is the kind of thing that went on for centuries. A warship there capturing a Spanish galleon. So the procedure was a suspected ship was stopped and the ship's papers were inspected. And if it was found to be a friendly ship or a neutral ship and it wasn't carrying enemy-owned cargo or it wasn't going between enemy ports, then it would probably be released. But if it was found to be an enemy ship or a neutral ship carrying cargo that's owned by the enemy or going to be used by them, then it would be taken as prize. And as well as the ship, all the papers on board the ship were collected up, including any mail in transit, because merchant ships carried quite a lot of mail in mail sacks. So when the ship was seized, the captors would put on a small skeleton crew on board the prize and sail it to a friendly port. Some of the crew from the captured ship would then testify before local commissioners. They had to answer lots of standard questions, but the purport of it all really was to get to the bottom of who really owned the ship and who really owned the cargo. Their testimony and all the papers from the ship were sent up to the High Court of Admiralty. The fact that the ship had been captured was publicised so that merchants who thought they had a claim on some of the cargo, perhaps, they could put in claims to the court. And with this information, the court then passed judgment. And the judgment could be either that the ship was condemned as lawful prize, in which case the value of the ship and the cargo were awarded to the captors. And that's the incentive for this for many. Because the captors, the ships capturing merchant ships, they were Royal Navy ships, but there are also many private warships which were licensed to do this in wartime. But if it wasn't condemned as lawful prize, then the ship and the cargo would be released and the captors would be liable for the costs and paying compensation to the people who've been unlawfully stopped. So the potential rewards were huge in this because cargoes could be very valuable indeed, but the hazards could be huge as well, could make your fortune or bankrupt you. Now what we have here in the HCA classes, the High Court of Admiralty, we have four kinds of paper really. We have the court papers. That's all of the papers created by the court during these prize trials. And there were, between the First Anglo-Dutch War and the end of the Napoleonic Wars, there were about 30,000 captured ships. The British captured about 30,000 enemy or neutral ships. And we have court papers for a great many of those. These are the evidences I talked about, the witness statements, claims from merchants, anything that the court created or was created for the court. Besides that, we have all the ship's papers. That's all the papers which were taken from the captured ship all the day-to-day kinds of things that ships would have, logbooks, crew lists, cargo manifests, all that kind of information. Then there's the another class of things, which are, again, papers taken from these captured ships, but merchant ships could be carrying all kinds of things. There are several sets, for example, of extensive business archives. People had, wealthy people in France, for example, owned estates in the West Indies, and so at certain times the business correspondence and all the business papers, the accounts, were being sent back to France, and if they were intercepted, then we get a great wadge of those kinds of papers. And the other kind of paper that was taken from the ships is all the mail in transit, mailbags full of letters which were never delivered. And we've got perhaps about 80,000 undelivered letters like that. Now, I'll just tell you one little story from these papers, just illustrates the kinds of papers that you might find. This is Captain Bisvik, or it might be. Pay attention to his headgear particularly. He was Johann Bisvik. He was the master of a ship called the Concordia of Bremen, a German merchant ship, and it was trading between Bremen and the Dutch West Indies island of St. Eustatius. And it was on its way from the West Indies to Amsterdam when it was captured by the British off Beachy Head on the 6th of April, 1758. But Bisvik has already died in the West Indies before that, and his place has been taken by the first mate, Aaron Buck. Now, these are all papers. All these papers I'm going to show you have come from the papers captured from this ship, the Concordia, his ship. This is a receipt in English. It says, 5th of July, 1757, bought of William and Edward Loxham a hat for 11 shillings, gold lace loop and buttons, 18 and 6, and cockade, a shilling. It's addressed to Captain John Bisvik. It's not quite like the hat in the illustration, but it's gold lace loop, this one. Here's another receipt. This is received April the 26, 1757, same year. Received for Captain Breesman. This is the same chap. He's spelt many different ways. 1 guinea in full for a hat. That's another hat. This is an invoice for, he's called Captain Bergeric here in French, but he's the same fella. This is his lodgings in St. Eustatius, up to 3 days before he died, actually. And it's just itemised his lodgings each day. You see, for example, on 6th of November, he had dinner and 2 bottles of white wine. Now, I mentioned that he died. Well, this is a bill from his doctor, Dr. Arding. This is in English. This is all in St. Eustatius. It's a nocturnal visit, a bleeding, an epileptic mixture, bleeding repeated, and then on the 16th of October, another bleeding and a purging draught. So if he wasn't feeling very well before. But he seemed to like other medical opinions, because this is a bill from a surgeon, another one, Daniel Roeder, a different one. This is in a mixture of Dutch and English for 3 emulsions, 2 mixtures, 14 doses of something, I don't know what it is. And here's another bill. This is French. This is from a French medical man, again for Captain Bisvik. And there's lots of herbal tea in there, but there's also laxatives and an extract of rhubarb at the bottom. And this is the first thing that I ever came across to do with this ship at all. The Concordia had an English bosun, and this is just an entry in his notebook. November the 19th, 1757, Captain John Bisvik departed this life and was buried the same night in St. Eustatius. And this is the last page of Bisvik's inventory of all his goods when he died. And there's lots of things like fine Nanking linen and things in there. So he's a man who liked to dress well and live the life. And the most interesting thing, I think, about him, we've seen all those bills, gives us a little clue about him. But this is a letter from another sailor, Harman Dirksen. He was another Bremen merchant, actually. And he was in St. Eustatius the same time as Captain Beestvik. This chap was the master of another ship, and he was loading. But he's writing to his wife here. I'll just give you a few extracts from this. My dear loving heart and wife, he says. He writes, this man is German, he's writing to his wife in Bremen, but he writes in English, or something like English. And I've had to rationalise it, I'm afraid, to read it out. I can only conclude from this, his wife must have been English, I think. He says, I hope with the assisting of the Almighty God that I will make a good profit for me and the owners. To see that I did like an honest man, I will not do like Captain Beestvik did. He did not die here, meaning he would not have died here, that the skip never would come away in time. He did spend here in 14 days about £100 by whoring and drinking and never be aboard of his ship. He dressed like a merchant with gold lace and a sword upon his side. I hope God Almighty will keep me from it. And then there's a postscript to his wife. He says, my dear, do not go to tell to the people in Bremen about Captain Beestvik's behaviour. You know what people is in Bremen. So that I would not have the name that I should write such thing. So I beg you will keep these things to yourselves. And the point is, he needn't have worried about his wife gossiping in Bremen, because she never got the letter, because it was in the mail of the Concordia. The Concordia was captured, so we have the letter. Like all the other intercepted mail we have, people never got them. So what we're doing here, I'm working with Andrew Little, who's about to speak, and Amanda Bevan, and two other colleagues, Helen Watt and Adam Asho. And we are trying to sort out the prize papers, which in fact are a tremendously muddled up collection. The papers that were captured from one ship are now, over the centuries, they've become randomly distributed amongst many different pieces. And any one box will have papers that were originally, they're all mixed up, they're from all different ships. And even letters, some letters, quite a lot of letters have been separated from their envelopes and from enclosures, and they're now not just in a different place in the same box, they're in a completely different piece. And in a few cases, they're even in a different class. So we're just trying to sort everything back to all the papers that were originally captured from one ship are back that way. So that's my very brief tour. I'll hand over now to Andrew, who's got another story for you.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for coming. Hope you've had a great day. I also work for the Haugen's Institute of Netherlands History, and I'm here because I'm helping particularly sort the Dutch 17th century material out. Now, because of that, I have to remind everybody that next year is the 350th anniversary of the Medway Raid, the conclusion of the Second Anglo-Dutch War, 1664-7, and one of the worst humiliations in British history. The Dutch sailed up the River Medway to the naval base at Chatham, burnt a number of the largest British warships, and captured the fleet flagship Royal Charles, of which this is the Royal Arms on the stern piece, which is still displayed in the Rijksmuseum at Amsterdam today. Now, this is a bird's eye view from Sheerness looking up the River Medway towards Chatham and Rochester. I've included this because if we zoom in a bit, we can see HMS Maria Sancta, or Sancta Maria, which was intended to have been scuttled as a block ship, but ran aground and was afterwards burnt down here. This ship is intimately linked to both the beginning and the end of the war. And the thing is, even when limited to the most strictly British study, the tightest British study, forget the international relevance of all this, even when we come to this very narrow focus, the prize papers can add vital information in proving the most basic history of the Royal Navy, principally because the 17th century Navy included a large number of prizes. British naval historians might think there is no more to do, but This ship is normally given as an ex-Venetian merchantman. That's not the case. The HCA prize papers show that Santa Maria van Concepcy, Santa Maria of Conception, of Amsterdam, was built as a Dutch Mediterranean trader to be well-armed and well-manned to fight off attacks by the unpredictable North African Barbary states. Now, we have a load of really nice detailed dimensions that you won't find in the standard reference books, and a load of inventories. And that is besides the astounding merchant archive of the type that Randolph was describing earlier on, and the mail in transit. It's a merchant network stretching from Cadiz all over the Italian peninsula to Venice. A huge number of papers covering the crew and the operation of the ship, and is truly multilingual in mainly Dutch, Italian, Spanish and French, and a number of sub-dialects. But I'd like to return just briefly to the nuts and bolts of history, the way in which HCA can contribute to basic history that we think's already been done. For instance, to the biographies of the Dutch admirals. This is Jacob van Wassenaar, Lord of Obdam. He was Dutch commander-in-chief from 1654 to 1665, and he was killed when his flagship blew up at the Battle of Lowestoft over on the right. Something like five men survived out of 400-odd. We have at TNA in HCA one of the last letters he ever wrote, written just a couple of days before he was killed at this battle. And we have it because the merchant ship that he put the letter on was afterwards captured. Another example of this kind of nuts and bolts of where HCA can contribute even to things that we think are already sewn up is this guy, Cornelis Evertsen the Youngest. He was Dutch Commander-in-Chief from 1684 to 1690, probably best known for retaking New York in 1673, and he was captured as a privateer captain in spring 1665. That's the privateer estate-licensed warship, privately owned, operating against trade. And we know this guy from, readers of Pepys and Evelyn will know them from those diarists. He was he met the king and was promptly released with a nice bag of gold coins. Now, in HCA, we have Evertsen's privateering commission. And technically, it's void. The reason for that is simply that there were three Cornelis Evertsens, all rose to admiral rank. The Dutch federal government simply issued the commission to the wrong man. Over on the left is the elder, then in the middle, the younger, who's the nephew of this guy on the left, and the youngest over on the far right, who was the son of the elder. Now, technically, the youngest could have been hung as a pirate because this privateering commission was void. Now, Evertsen's privateer carried a number of letters to the crews of other privateers operating in the mouth of the Channel and in the Biscay, Spanish waters as well. Now, sailors, like others in the lower orders, if you like, are usually as anonymous as these tiny figures on this drawing. And when we do see the lower orders, it's usually as the mob, you know, the drunken and immoral. And these drawings of Dutch sailors, these are rather rare. But for me, the jewel in the prize papers is the survival of the letters of the common sailors, their wives and their families. And much of their news might seem routine. The more sensational include one sailor's wife calling another's wife a Jewish whore, which gives rise to a huge legal case, and you know, we've got that. It also actually matches up with archives in Holland. Another sailor writes home to his wife, "I love this. I can't wait to lie next to your naked body." And he writes home from Guinea. He's off the coast of Guinea and he writes that. Now, we don't often get gems like that, I can tell you, but I hope to find some more. And one of the reasons why we don't find these things is because we don't have them in other places, is because paper was valuable and it was recycled or sold, you know, often as toilet paper. The only reason, as Randolph said, is that these letters survive and these papers survive is because they were captured. Now, I want to leave you with an example of the challenges that the team that are sorting the HCA papers face. This is a shoe pattern. It's a shoe pattern with no name or date on it, and it was found loose in one of the boxes by a Dutch historian and published simply as a miscellaneous 17th century item of interest. Now, earlier this year, I found a different one in another box in the same hand. It basically just says, you know, pattern, sole of my shoe, you know, make up two or three of these and send them to me. And here they are side by side. So the published one's on the right. And they do actually match size-wise, apart from one's got a cut-off toe. Now, after all of yesterday, this has been bugging me for some time because, well, it's clearly the same hand. And as we worked on the boxes that these were in, the hand became familiar, and you think, oh, go back, he's trying to sort the correspondence by date and by sender. And you know, I recognised the hand, and I thought, I want to crack this because, well, one of the things I have to do, or one of the things I am tasked with doing if there's enough time, because there's so much to do, is to identify all the stuff that the Dutch have written a lot about this stuff and published a lot of material. And when it gets moved, we'd like to keep a really nice track of it so that all the authors can be informed. And I thought this would be a really nice little mystery to solve for you guys today. And it turns out that these shoe patterns were sent for in 1672 from a colonial official in Suriname in South America. And with a little bit of work, we've managed to, because everything was loose, we've managed to put them, find the associated letters that said, you know, enclosed as a shoe pattern or enclosed as a list with a shoe pattern in. One captured in March 1672, before they knew, he wrote that before they knew war was declared, for the third Anglo, at the start of the third Anglo-Dutch War. We've got his letter, the list, a bill of lading as well, identifying the recipient of the addressee, because there is no envelope for either of these. The envelopes have been destroyed. We can't find them yet. Maybe we will in the future. And the second one on the right was captured aboard Witte Zeepaard, or White Seahorse, early the following year. There's also another letter, which I haven't put up, which is the shoes you last sent don't fit. So I'm sending, you know, we've got hats that that Randolph was talking about, and we've also got shoes. And this is a really big problem for clothing for a colonial official in the sickly colony of Suriname who needs to have a decent pair of shoes. And I'll leave you with that. Thank you very much.
This talk was recorded on the 25th of November 2016 at the National Archives, Kew.
This podcast is copyright to the National Archives, all rights reserved. It is available for reuse under the terms of the Open Government Licence.